Who will be our speaker today. David was born in Hertfordshire in England, and he grew up in southern England. He studied history and literature at the University of Kiel and received a BA with first class honors. Then he received an MA in the history of ideas from the University of Sussex. After that, he and his wife, Rosalind, immigrated to Canada and settled in Kingston, Ontario. David obtained his PhD in modern history from Queen's in 1978 and taught there before joining Athabasca University in 1979. He is professor of history and humanities, teaching mainly European history and music history. Dr. Gregory is a former president of the Folklore Studies Association of Canada and is currently a director of the Canadian Society for Traditional Music. He currently edits the quarterly periodical Canadian Folk Music, La Musique, Musique de Folklore Canadienne. He has published numerous books and articles, and he's currently writing a book on the late Victorian folk song revival and researching one on the life and work of English folk song collector Lucy Broadwood. And it's from that work, I believe, or the work on that work, that he's going to speak to us today. We have the added treat of having Rosie here with us. She's going to illustrate the talk by singing some of the songs. So thanks very much, and here's David.
Thank you, Kathy. This talk is called Lucy Broadwood, The Early Years, and I'd just like to start by thanking my wife Rosie for coming to sing some of the songs that Lucy collected, and my daughter Fiona for helping me with the visuals of the PowerPoint slides. So, Lucy Broadwood, The Early Years. About a year ago, a book of mine was published. It was called Victorian Song Hunters. Victorian Song Hunters is a history of vernacular song collecting in Victorian England, but it only takes the story as far as 1883, whereas Queen Victoria, of course, outlived the 19th century, although only just, since she died in 1901. Well, the last chapter of Victorian Song Hunters is titled The Birth of a Folk Song Revival, and it discusses, although rather briefly, a transitional decade of song collecting that deserves a more detailed examination as the beginning of another story that took place during the remaining two decades of the Victorian era. I'm currently writing up that story in a sequel to Victorian Song Hunters, and this book is provisionally titled The Persistence of Melody, The Late Victorian Folk Song Revival, 1878 to 1903. Well, the late Victorian folk song revival involved several dozen collectors working in a variety of English counties. But there are five or six names that stand out as both pioneers and mainstays of the movement. The heroes include a musician editor from Newcastle upon Tyne called John Stoker, a West Country clergyman named Sabine Baring Gould, and a Yorkshire painter and music historian called Frank Gidson. The heroines include Shropshire folklorist Charlotte Byrne and the lady that this talk is about, Lucy Broadwood. A book on Lucy Broadwood? Well, in researching the Persistence of Melody, I found Lucy so interesting that I've decided to explore her life and work in more detail, and I hope write another book, this time on her alone. It will actually be in collaboration with an English folk singer called Irene Shettle, whom I met in a Surrey archive, also doing research on Lucy. So why is Lucy so interesting? Well, one key reason is because she saved a wealth of beautiful and interesting songs for us simply by taking the trouble to collect them. Here's an example, a broadside ballad about transportation to Tasmania for the crime of poaching.
Come, all you gallant poachers that ramble free from care, that walk out of home at midnight with your dog, your gun, and snare. with a lofty hair and pheasant, you have at your command, not thinking that your last career is in Van Diemen's land. There was poor Tom Brown from Nottingham, Jack Williams and poor Joe were three as daring poachers as the country well can know. At night they were trepanned by the keepers hid in sand, and for 14 years transported were unto Van Diemen's land. Oh, when we sailed from England, we landed at the bay. We had rotten straw for bedding, we dared not to say nay. Our cots were fenced with fire, we slumber when we can, to drive away the wolves and tigers upon Van Diemen's land. Oh, when that we were landed upon that fatal shore, the planters they came flocking round, full 20 score or more. They ranked us up like horses and sold us out of hand. They yoked us to the plough, my boys, to plough Van Diemen's land. There was one girl from England, Susan Summers was her name. For 14 years transported was, we all well knew the same. Our planter bought her freedom, and he married her out of hand. Good usage then she gave to us upon Van Diemen's land. Oh, oft when I am slumbering, I have a pleasant dream. With my sweet girl I'm sitting down by some purling stream. Through England I am roaming with her at my command. Then waken broken hearted upon Van Diemen's land. God bless our wives and families, likewise that happy shore, the Isle of Sweet Contentment, which we shall see no more. As for our wretched females, see them we seldom can. There are 20 men to 1 woman upon Van Diemen's land. Come, all you gallant poachers, give ear unto my song. It is a bit of good advice, although it is not long. Let be your dog and snare, to you I do speak plain. If you knew the hardships we endure, you never would poach again.
So, who was Lucy Broadwood? Lucy was born in Melrose, Scotland on August the 9th, 1858, the youngest surviving child of Juliana Maria and Henry Fowler Broadwood. The Broadwoods were an extended family with roots in Northumberland, but by the Victorian era, most of them had moved to southern England. Socially, they were an upper middle class family with money, a country estate at Lyne on the Surrey-Sussex border, and a position in London society. That position derived essentially from a successful manufacturing business and from the classical music concert series that the family firm sponsored, the Broadwood Concerts. John Broadwood and Son built pianos, including prestigious high-quality top-of-the-line models that were owned by such musicians as Haydn, Mozart, Beethoven, Chopin, Liszt, and Elgar, among others. They were mentioned in Jane Austen's novels, and the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Arthur Conan Doyle, was just one of many Victorian literati and artists who possessed one. Lucy the musician. Lucy did not lack for a musical education. She had piano and singing lessons as a child, and she proved talented in both areas. As an adult, she was an excellent amateur pianist, much in demand as an accompanist for even professional singers. She was also a fine trained voice singer, who at one point nearly embarked on a professional singing career, and who often performed in public charity concerts. And she was a proficient arranger of folk songs and of vocal works by Purcell and Bach, two of her favorite composers. In about 1900, Lucy was in her early 40s. She was not very wealthy, but she did have a private income, enough money to rent a London apartment and to keep a cook and a maid. Her time was her own, and she spent a lot of it making music, playing the piano and singing. She was a fairly typical Victorian intellectual in that she read widely, she wrote poetry, she was a prodigious correspondent, she frequently attended art exhibitions and regularly went to the theatre, the opera, and classical music concerts. She, of course, had a free pass to the Broadwood series. And she even made the pilgrimage to Bayreuth to see the ring. At Bayreuth, in fact, she enjoyed Parsifal more than the ring, a reflection perhaps of her Christian faith and her fascination with mythology, anthropology, folklore, and comparative religion. Interests that would lead her to a close friendship with Theosophist George Mead, to regularly participate in meetings of the Quest Society, and among her acquaintances, she included not only Carl Jung, but Sir James Frazer, the author of The Golden Bough, and Jesse Weston, the author of From Ritual to Romance, and several books on the Grail Quest. From Ritual to Romance, you might know, is the book that to a large degree T.S. Eliot based The Wasteland on. Afterwards I could go into more detail about this aspect of Lucy the intellectual, which I think is very interesting, but it's not specially germane to what I'm talking about this time, her folk song collecting, so for the moment we'll leave it there. Her musical life resulted in friendships with many eminent Victorian composers, including Sir Alexander Mackenzie, Sir Hubert Parry, Sir Charles Villiers Stanford, Arthur Somerville, Ralph Vaughan Williams, Percy Grainger, and several of the pioneers of the early music revival, including Barclay Squire and Alec Fuller Maitland. She also had a very close relationship with a handsome young professional singer, the baritone James Campbell McInnes, in whose career she took great interest. Now, at least so far in my research, it's unclear to me whether this relationship remained platonic. It may have done, despite the fact that they took the occasional weekend in Paris together, because of the social mores of the time, because of the disparity in their ages, and because of the fact that McInnes, although he was twice married and had children, was also gay. And for a time between his marriages, he lived with the composer Graham Peel. Lucy, incidentally, may have been a lesbian. She never married, though she had offers, and she had several intense relationships with women, including the concert pianist Fanny Davies. Ralph Vaughan Williams was another very close friend, close enough that he dedicated one of his early compositions to her and took note of her criticism of the orchestral scoring of one of the movements of his C symphony, his first symphony. Vaughan Williams, of course, became a major folk song collector himself in the Edwardian era, and he always reckoned Lucy as an important early influence on his musical life. In April 1923, he wrote her a letter of appreciation that included the following lines. "If I only just say thank you, it means I can't say all I should like to. But I remember years ago at St. George's Square," which was Lucy's house in London at the time, when I was very raw, how you showed me Purcell and Bach and many things I did not know. And as to folk song, it was you who first introduced me to it. Vaughan Williams was not the only prominent Edwardian composer to credit Lucy with being a major influence on him. In November 1925, the Australian composer Percy Grainger, by then living in the USA, wrote the following. I want to say how very deeply I personally feel gratitude to you for your wonderful work in editing the Folk Song Society Journal for so long and so perfectly. It was that lecture of yours at the Folk Song Society that determined me to take up collecting actively. Through the beautiful spirit of that lecture, I was led into paths that have meant so much to me and to my life's work. The popularizing of English folk song I've been able to do all had its roots in that lecture of yours and the fragrance of country melody that it radiated. Granger was alluding here to a talk about folk song collecting that Lucy had delivered to a meeting of the Folk Song Society in 1905. She had illustrated it with examples of her own collecting, such as a folk lyric with a beautiful modal melody that she had noted from one of her most prolific informants, Henry Burstow. It was called Belfast Mountains.
Well, on the Belfast Mountains I heard a maid complain, making forth her lamentation down by some purling stream, saying, my heart is fettered fast in the bonds of love, all by a false pretender who doth inconstant prove. Oh, Johnny, my dear jewel, don't treat me with disdain, nor leave me here behind you in sorrow to complain. With her arms she clasps around him like violets round the vine, saying, my bonny Cheshire lad, you've stolen this heart of mine. My dear, I'm sorry for you that you for me should grieve. I am engaged already, 'tis you I can't relieve. Since it is so, my Johnny, forever I'm undone. Oh, by this shame and scandal, I shall distracted run. If I'd but all those diamonds on yonder rock that grow, I would give them to my Cheshire lad if his love to me he'd show. Wringing her hands and crying, my Johnny dear, farewell. Unto those Belfast mountains my sorrow I will tell. It's not those Belfast mountains can give to me relief, nor is it in their power to ease me of my grief. If they'd but a tongue to prattle, to tell my love a tale, unto my bonny Cheshire lad, my mind they would reveal.
But how did Lucy come to have such an influence on the leading composers of her generation? And what royal roles had she played in the folk song revival? Well, Lucy was at the heart of the English folk song movement for nearly 50 years, from the late 1880s until her sudden death at the age of 71 in August 1929, actually when she was attending a music festival near Canterbury. So this long involvement is one of the reasons why only a book-length study can do justice to her contribution to English folk song. First then, a quick overview of her most significant contributions, and then a more detailed look at her early song collecting. Lucy's collecting and editing. She was a pioneer collector of English folk songs during the late Victorian era, later changing her focus to Irish and Scottish song, including Gaelic melodies. She was the editor of two important English folk song collections in the late Victorian decades, Sussex Songs of 1889 and English County Songs 1893. To these she eventually added a third, English Traditional Songs and Carols, in 1908, but that was mainly based on her collecting in the mid to late 1890s, in any case. Lucy's work with the Folk Song Society. She served as Honorary Secretary of the Folk Song Society on several occasions, in particular during the heady days of the mid-1900s, when she strove to keep the movement's enthusiastic but troublesome young Turks, especially Cecil Sharp, Rayfawn Williams and Percy Grainger, working in some kind of harness with the old guard of Parry, Somerville, Fuller Maitland, Baring Gould and Kidson, among others. She edited the Journal of the Folk Song Society for several decades and almost single-handedly was responsible for an impressive series of issues that collectively presented substantial samples from the work of most of the English folk song collectors active in the two decades between 1904 and 1924. And then, after stepping down as editor, she briefly took over as president of the society until her sudden death. So that's our sort of rather lengthy introductory overview, and now back to the beginning and a brief look at Lucy Broadwood's folk song collecting in late Victorian England in the 1880s and the 1890s. To start with, it's evident that folk song was in the Broadwood family. It was part of Broadwood family life. Lucy recalled her father singing her to sleep with nursery versions of folk songs at a very early age. Her favourite was the Wee Crudlin Do. She also remembered as a child of six hearing certain old labourers in smock frocks coming about Christmas time to sing ballads, and a little later, an old man and his two sons singing outside the front door a long ballad called The Green Mossy Banks of the Lee. Lucy's father had done some song collecting himself in the 1830s, but the big name in the family in this regard was Uncle John Broadwood, the editor of Old English Songs. Now, Old English Songs is the short title. The full title was Old English Songs as Now Sung by the Peasantry of the Weald of Surrey and Sussex and collected by one who has learnt them by hearing them sung every Christmas from early childhood by the country people who go about the neighbouring houses singing, or wassailing as it is called, at that season. The airs are set to music exactly as they're now sung to rescue them from oblivion and to afford a specimen of genuine Old English melody. And the words are given in their original rough state, with occasional slight alteration to render the sense intelligible. It was published in 1847 with tunes harmonized for piano accompaniment by Charles Dussart, who was an organist from Worthing. Well, Uncle John was a pioneer folk song collector in the early Victorian era. And he is significant because he made a point of reproducing modal tunes and ballad texts as faithfully as possible, one of the earliest people to do so. To quote Lucy, "My uncle had a wonderfully accurate musical ear and voice, and wonderful obstinacy. This latter quality stood him in good stead when fighting with the organist of Worthing, who raised lamentable cries at the flat seventh and other monstrous intervals which Mr. Broadwood sang or blew persistently on his flute. Musically," said my uncle, "they may be quite wrong, but the tunes shall be printed as they were sung to me and as I sing them to you." He won the battle, and the result is of striking interest. Now, Lucy inherited that commitment to scholarly accuracy, and she loved the songs that her uncle had gathered in the nearby villages along the Surrey-Sussex border. She and her cousin Herbert Birch Reynardson were less enthusiastic about Dussart's arrangements, and they determined to bring out a new edition of the slim book with new arrangements by Herbert. This was published in 1889 as Sussex Songs, and it included some extra items that Lucy had recently collected in the same area. They included the folk carol, The Moon Shines Bright, and the hunting song, The Sweet Rosy Morning. But Lucy did not stop there. She now had the collecting bug, and in the early 1890s, she succeeded in tracking down a number of rural informants who provided her with old songs of different kinds. One of her most valuable early singers was Samuel Willett, a baker who lived in the Sussex village of Cuckfield. He provided her with 27 songs, for which she paid him 27 shillings, a bargain if ever there was one. One of them was a drinking song about a blacksmith, Twankey Dillo.
Here's a health to the jolly blacksmith, the best of all fellows, who works at his anvil while the boy blows the bellows, which makes my bright hammer to rise and to fall. Here's to old coal and to young coal and to old coal of all. Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, 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 Dillo. A roaring pair of bagpipes made of the green willows. If a gentleman calls his horse for to shoe, he makes no denial of one pot or two, for it makes my bright hammer to rise and to fall. Here's to old coal and to young coal and to old coal of all. Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, 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 Dillo. And he that loves strong beer is a hearty good fellow. Here's a health to King Charlie, and likewise his queen, and all the royal little ones where'er they are seen, which makes my bright hammer to rise and to fall. Here's to old coal and to young coal and to old coal of all. Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, Twankey Dillo, 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 Dillo. A roaring pair of bagpipes made of the green willow.
And as you can see by the internal reference, that's from the late 17th century. And bagpipes really should be blowpipes. That's a corruption, I think. Well, the Broadwood family had an extensive network of relatives and friends, and Lucy's strange new project was by now common knowledge in such circles. In consequence, it was often other people who located source singers for Lucy, though she then went to visit them herself if they appeared to have promising material. Cousin Herbert, for example, took her to the village of King's Langley in Hertfordshire, where she found Mrs. Clara Wilson, the wife of a local gardener. Clara Wilson proved to be another of Lucy's best informants, singing, among many other songs, the child ballad Lord Bateman, the folk lyric The Sprig of Time, a decidedly feminist broadside ballad titled The Undaunted Female, and a couple of folk carols in Bethlehem City and As I Sat on a Sunny Bank. The second of these is better known as I Saw Three Ships, or On Christmas Day in the Morning.
As I sat on a sunny bank, a sunny bank, a sunny bank, as I sat on a sunny bank on Christmas Day in the morning, I saw three ships come sailing in, come sailing in, come sailing in. I saw three ships come sailing in on Christmas Day in the morning. I asked them what they had in, what they had in, what they had in. I asked them what they had in on Christmas Day in the morning. They said they had the Saviour in, the Saviour in, the Saviour in. They said they had the Saviour in on Christmas Day in the morning. I asked them where they found him, where they found him, where they found him. I asked them where they found him on Christmas Day in the morning. They said they found him in Bethlehem, in Bethlehem, in Bethlehem. They said they found him in Bethlehem on Christmas Day in the morning. Now all the bells on earth shall ring, on earth shall ring, on earth shall ring. Now all the bells on earth shall ring on Christmas Day in the morning. And all the angels in heaven shall sing, in heaven shall sing, in heaven shall sing. And all the angels in heaven shall sing on Christmas Day in the morning.
There are other valuable informants that Lucy herself tracked down, or her friends and relatives located for her. Sister Ada, for example, is the first to bring back songs from the hamlet of Anstey near Holmwood in Surrey, where she had obtained them from an elderly carter named Mr. Grantham. Lucy followed up this lead, travelling to Anstey, and noting several items from Grantham's repertoire, including the Sweet Nightingale, Sheep, Crook and Black Dog, and the Painful Plough. Another of Lucy's source singers was John Burberry, the Lyne gamekeeper, from whom she collected the carter's health and the seasons of the year. And in the fall of 1892, Herbert took Lucy to stay at his father's mansion, which was called Adwell House and was located near Tetsworth in Oxfordshire. And here she noted many rustic songs, her phrase in her diary record of the visit, from Patience Vasey, the wife of the Reynoldson's gardener. Patience had grown up in the county of Hampshire, and one of the songs she had learned there as a child was a rather beautiful one, My Bonny Bonny Boy, which quickly became one of Lucy's favourite songs. For this, and the other items that Lucy noted from her, Patience was rewarded with a box of 6 handkerchiefs. And Rosie will sing My Bonny Bonny Boy.
I once loved a boy, and a bonny bonny boy. I loved him, I'll vow and protest. I loved him so well, and so very, very well, that I built him a berth on my breast, on my breast. That I built him a berth on my breast. 'Twas up the green valley and down the green grove, like one that was troubled in mind. She whooped and she hallowed and she played upon her pipe, but no bonny boy could she find. But no bonny boy could she find. She looked up high, and she looked down low. The sun did shine wonderful warm. Whom should she spy there but her bonny bonny boy, so close in another girl's arms, so close in another girl's arms. I passed him by, on him ne'er cast an eye, though he stretched forth his lily-white hand. For I thought he'd been bound to love but one, so I would not obey his command. So I would not obey his command. A girl that was loved of my little bonny boy, sure she is greatly to blame. For many's the night he has robbed me of rest, but he never shall do it again. But he never shall do it again. My bonnie, bonnie boy, he's gone over the sea. I fear I shan't see him again. But were I to have him, where were I to not? I will think of him once, now and then. I will think of him once, now and then.
Many of the best songs that Lucy collected during the early 1890s were included in her second publication, a collection of folk songs that she edited jointly with her friend and relative, music journalist and early music enthusiast, Alec Fuller Maitland. English County Songs attempted a county-by-county coverage of the vernacular music of England. Lucy had yet to do any serious collecting in the north of England, so her personal contributions were from the counties of Surrey and Sussex. The majority of the contents of English County Songs had not been collected by either Lucy or Alec Fuller Maitland. The two editors obtained most of their material from an extensive network of correspondence. And, in the circumstances, they did amazingly well to find at least one song from every county except Bedfordshire, Huntingdonshire and Monmouthshire. Fuller Maitland was responsible for the composite text of this next song, which he stitched together from several different sources. But the tune, which I think has an Irish feel to it, was noted by an organist friend of Lucy's, A.J. Hipkins, who was another leading light in the early music movement. It's a version of Child Ballad No. 56, Dives and Lazarus.
As it fell out upon one day, rich Divers he made a feast, and he invited all his friends and gentry of the best. And it fell out upon one day, poor Lazarus he was so poor, he came and laid him down and down, even down at Divers' door. And it fell out upon one day, poor Lazarus he was so poor, he came and laid him down and down, even down at Divers' door. So Lazarus laid him down and down, even down at Divers' door. Some meat, some drink, brother Diver, else to bestow upon the poor. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, lying begging at my door. No meat, no drink will I give thee, nor bestow upon the poor. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, lying begging at my door. No meat, no drink will I give thee, nor bestow upon the poor. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, even down at Diverus' wall. Some meat, some drink, brother Diverus, or surely starve I shall. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, lying begging at my wall. No meat, no drink will I give thee, and therefore starve thou shall. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, I'm begging at my wall. No meat, no drink will I give thee, and therefore starve thou shalt. Then Lazarus laid him down and down, even down at Diverus' gate. Some meat, some drink, brother Diverus, for Jesus Christ his sake. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, lying begging at my gate. No meat, no drink will I give thee, for Jesus Christ his sake. Thou art none of mine, brother Lazarus, lying begging at my gate. No meat, no drink will I give thee, for Jesus Christ his sake. Then Diverus sent his merry men all to whip poor Lazarus away. They had not power to whip one whip, but threw their whips away. Then Diverus sent out his hungry dogs to bite poor Lazarus away. They had not power to bite one bite, but licked his sores away. Then Diverus sent out his hungry dogs to bite poor Lazarus away. They had not power to bite one bite, but licked his sores away. As it fell out upon one day, poor Lazarus he sickened and died. Then came two angels out of heaven, his soul there too to guide. Rise up, brother Lazarus, and come along with me. There is a place prepared in heaven for to sit upon an angel's knee. Rise up, brother Lazarus, and come along with me. There is a place prepared in heaven for to sit upon an angel's knee. And it fell out upon one day, rich Diverus he sickened and died. There came two serpents out of hell, his soul there too to guide. Rise up, brother Diverus, and come along with me. There is a place prepared in hell for to sit upon a serpent's knee. Rise up, brother Diverus, and come along with me. There is a place prepared in hell for to sit upon a serpent's knee.
Well, the commercial and critical success of English County Songs consolidated Lucy's role as a leader of the folk song revival. It also encouraged her to keep on collecting folk songs. The next major informant that she found claimed to know over 400 songs. He was a 68-year-old shoemaker and bell ringer from Horsham, Sussex, called Henry Burstow. Lucy later wrote the following brief account of Burstow. As a boy, he was apprenticed to the shoemaking trade, but he is best known as a bell ringer. It has lately been written of him that his reputation stands unrivaled in England, and there is hardly a belfry in the land where his name and fame are not known and respected. And this, although during 83 years he has slept only 6 nights away from his native town. Mr. Burstow has from childhood made bell ringing and song singing his hobbies. He has a list of more than 400 songs, old and new, which he knows by heart. Amongst them are about 50 or 60 of the traditional ballad type, and these have been noted and preserved. Mr. Burstow learned some of his songs from his parents, and many old songs and ballads of shoemakers singing at their work. Others he learned from labourers, many of whom could not read. His excellent ear and sense of rhythm have probably been developed by constant bell ringing, in which he still joins with energy and skill. Well, one of the many songs she noted from him was the ballad Georgie.
As I rode over Banstead Downs one mid-May morning early, there I espied a pretty fair maid lamenting for her Georgie. Saint Georgie never stood on the king's highway, he never robbed money, but he stole 15 of the king's fat deer and sent them to Lord Navy. Oh, come and saddle my milk-white steed and bridle it already, that I may go to my good Lord Judge and ask for the life of my Georgie. And when she came to the good Lord Judge, she fell down upon her knees already, saying, my good Lord Judge, come pity me, grant me the life of my Georgie. The judge, he looked over his left shoulder, he seemed as he was very sorry. My pretty fair maid, you are come too late, for he's condemned already. He will be hung in a silken cord where there has not been many. For he came of royal blood and courted a virtuous lady. I wish I was on yonder hill, where times I have been many. With a sword and a buckler by my side, I'd fight for the life of my Georgie. I wish I was on yonder hill, where times I have been many. With a sword and a buckler by my side, I would fight for the life of my Georgie.
The success of English County Songs brought Lucy new friendships with other late Victorian song collectors. Among them was Yorkshire music historian Frank Kidson. Kidson sent Lucy an autographed copy of his book, Traditional Tunes. Thereafter they corresponded regularly. Lucy visited him in Leeds, and they met whenever he travelled down to London. Another new friend and correspondent was the Reverend Sabine Baring-Gould. Baring-Gould was a major Victorian novelist. He was the leading folk song collector in Devon, the editor of Songs and Ballads of the West and other collections. But he's probably best known as the author of the hymn Onward Christian Soldiers. He contributed a few songs to English County Songs, and he kept Lucy informed of the new material he was gathering in Devon and Cornwall. And Lucy and Sabine actually went song hunting together in Devon in September 1893. She was invited down to stay at the vicarage, the rectory, which was also a manor house, because he was a squire as well as a rector. At Milton Abbott in Devon, they found an elderly singer, Mrs. Anne Jeffrey, who sang a local version of a child ballad, number 78, The Unquiet Grave. Lucy already knew a Shropshire version of the song, collected by her folklorist friend Charlotte Byrne, and she had included it in English County Songs. The Devon tune and words were a little different, and Mrs. Jeffrey knew the ballad as Cold Blows the Wind.
Cold blows the wind, oh my true love, cold blow the drops of rain. I never had but one true love, in greenwood he was slain. My time be long, my time be short, tomorrow or today. Sweet Christ in heaven will have my soul and take my life away. Don't grieve for me, true love, no mourning do I crave. I must leave you and all the world and sink down in my grave.
Collecting with the assistance of Baring-Gould was a luxury that Lucy did not usually have. And finding singers was not always at all easy. To quote Lucy, "You may indeed live all your life in the country and hear no note of traditional song. Question those who are working hardest for the welfare of the country people around them, and you will probably be answered that no one in the neighbourhood sings anything old. This county is quite unmusical. But gain the confidence of man, woman, or child in that same place by singing a genuine folk tune or by quoting a genuine ballad to them, and you will usually find doors open to you. You will hear singers enough, and you will learn of their sing-songs, of which they vie with each other in remembering the greatest number of songs or those with the greatest number of verses." Class was not the only obstacle between Lucy and the songs that she sought. Another barrier was her gender. As a woman, she suffered from restrictions that her male counterparts did not have to deal with. As she observed, a little ruefully, the privileged man collector can make merry with songsters in the alehouse over pipes and parsnip wine, or hobnob with a black sheep of the neighbourhood whose songs are apt to be as primitive and wild as himself, only much more lovely. The problem was that her male informants all had songs that they were too embarrassed to sing to a lady. As Mr. Grantham the Carter put it, most of them be outway rude. Henry Burstow refused to sing Salisbury Plain to Lucy, but instead handed her a sealed envelope with the words to pass to a gentleman of her acquaintance. And he couldn't remember the tune without seeing the words, so she couldn't collect it. These were the first three verses. They don't seem so outlandish to us nowadays, but in the context of the time. As I walked out over Salisbury Plain, oh, there I met a scamping young blade. He kissed me and enticed me so, till along with him I was forced to go. We came into a public house at last, and there for man and wife did pass. He called for ale and wine and strong beer, and at length to bed we did repair. Oh, undress yourself, my darling, then, said he. Oh, undress yourself and come to bed with me. Oh, yes, then will I, said she, if you'll keep them flash girls away. Gypsies presented another difficulty for the female song collector, although they often proved wonderful informants if they could be located and persuaded to sing. One of Lucy's rare successes with a band of travellers was with a group who camped on the common in the vicinity of Lyne. The Goby family provided her with a composite variant of two medieval religious ballads, St. Stephen and Herod, and the Carmel and the Crane. And incidentally, there's a lot of controversy about how old the oldest English ballads are. And you can probably count the number that are genuinely from and proven from the medieval period on a couple of hands. But St. Stephen and Herod and the Carmel and the Crane are definitely two that are from at least the 14th century, if not earlier. The Goby family's ballad was titled King Ferim, which was probably a corruption of Pharaoh, although the king should really be Herod. And the story derived from one of the apocryphal gospels. The text is rather corrupt, so the ballad seems a bit muddled, but some of the key ideas are there, such as the miracle of the roasted cock coming to life, the flight of Mary and Joseph to Egypt, and the baby Jesus' intervention to speed up miraculously the growth of the crops. So here's King Ferim.
King Ferim sat amusing all alone. There came the blessed Saviour, and all to him unknown. Say, where did you come from, good man, or where did you then pass? It is out of the land of Egypt, between an ox and an ass. Oh, if you come out of Egypt, man, one thing I fain would know, whether a blessed Virgin Mary sprung from a Holy Ghost. For if this is true, good man, that you've been telling to me, that the roasted cock do crow three times in the place where they did stand. Oh, it straight away the cock did fetch and feather to your own hand. Three times a roasted cock did crow on the place where they did stand. Joseph, Jesus, and Mary were travelling for the west. When Mary grew tired, she might sit down and rest. They travel further and further, the weather being so warm, till they came unto some husbandman, a sowing of his corn. Come, husbandman, cried Jesus, from over speed and pride, and carry home your ripened corn that you've been sowing this day. For to keep your wife and family from sorrow, grief, and pain. And keep Christ in your remembrance till the time comes round again.
Well, there were some years when Lucy did not collect many or even any folk songs. In the mid-1890s, for example, she was at the height of her career as an amateur opera singer and performed the role of Elvira in a London production of Mozart's Don Giovanni and that of Dorabella in a follow-up production of Così fan tutte. She was also an enthusiastic member of the early music movement, and her friendship with Alec Fuller Maitland and British Museum musicologist W. Bartley Squire enticed her into a major scholarly project for the Purcell Society, editing two of Purcell's lost, so-called lost operas, Amphitryon and the Gordian Knot. And she was doing lots of recitals, mixing art songs and arias with some of her favorite folk songs, including The Three Ravens, The Keys of Heaven, The North Country Lass, and The Loyal Lover. And she also decided to acquire some new practical skills, such as learning to bicycle. She did resume collecting in the fall of 1896 at the village of Dunsfold in Surrey. She recorded her visit in her diary as follows. Went to a small old cottage done up by Mr. and Mrs. Carr. Mrs. Carr received me, walked with her to see some cottagers about old songs. In the afternoon, ditto. In the evening, 10 or 12 old men, labourers, none able to read, came to supper and to sing to us. They sang sitting with eyes shut. Amongst others, they knew and sang Banks of Sweet Dundee, The Lady in the Box, Bailiff's Daughter of Islington, Cold Blows the Wind, The Trees They Are So High, Young Lampkin, Abroad as I Was Walking, A Ship Lies in the Harbour, etc., etc., etc. Interesting evening. I noted 14 old tunes.
And there we have a cottage.
Dunsfold, just to show you where she was collecting. Lucy was aware that Baring Gould had collected the traditional ballad, The Trees They Do Grow High, in Devon, and she had included an edited version, and he had included an edited version of it in Songs and Ballads of the West. She also knew of a broadside text, actually printed by the broadside publisher Such, titled My Bonnie Lad Is Young, But He's Growing. The version sung in Dunsfold, actually by Mr. Ede, had a different tune and some variation in the words from that noted in Devon. For example, the age of the young lovers was even younger, namely 12 and 13, respectively. Lucy first heard it sung when Ede was trimming hedges, and she reported that the fierce snap of his shears at the words, so there was an end to his growing, came with a startling, dramatic effect. She would publish Ede's text without censoring it in 1902 in the Journal of the Folk Song Society. So this is the Dunsfold version.
Oh, the trees are getting high, and the leaves are getting green. The time is past and gone, my love, that you and I have seen. 'Twas on the winter's evening, as I sat all alone, there I spied a bonny boy, young but growing. Oh, mother, dear mother, you've done to me much wrong. You've married me to a bonny boy, his age it is so young. His age is only 12, and myself scarcely 13, saying my bonny boy is young, but a-growing. It's daughter, dear daughter, I've done to you no wrong. I've married you to a bonny boy, he is some rich lord's son. And a lady she will make you, that's if you will be made. Saying your bonny boy is young, but a growing. Oh mother, dear mother, I'm but a child, it's true. I'll go back to my old college for another year or two. I'll cut off my yellow hair, put my box up on my head, and I'll gang along with it to the college. And at the age of 13, he was a married man. And at the age of 14, the father of a son. And at the age of 15, then his grave was growing green. So there was an end to his growing.
And that's the only song we have, the last song we have time for. Lucy would continue collecting folk songs, if only episodically, for another 20 years. As a collector, her focus changed to Gaelic song from Scotland and Ireland. Her role in the folk song movement changed too. With the formation of the Folk Song Society in 1898, she became heavily involved in committee work and correspondence, serving as its honorary secretary. In the Edwardian era, she also took over, as I mentioned earlier, as editor of the Journal of the Folk Song Society, an onerous task that she performed very ably for two decades. But Lucy's exploits in the Edwardian era are another story, one for which we have no time today. In a few years' time, I hope, there will be a book in which you can read all about her life, her times, and above all, her folk song collecting. And in the meantime, we can still sing some of those wonderful songs that she saved from passing away with her elderly informants. Thank you. Sure.
The question I have is, unsurprisingly, about the tune to Divers and Lazarus. What is the relative age of the Star of the County Down and that song? Because it's the same tune.
I
wonder
what
you
it's interesting because that tune is actually a hymn tune. So it's probably, I can't say, how old. The curious thing is, it does have that Irish feel to it. So it may have originated in Ireland, come over to England, being used as the hymn tune, and had this ballad set to it. Now there are other tunes to which versions of Divers and Lazarus are put. So I mean, the whole relationship of text and tunes in folk song is endlessly complicated. And the sources of the tunes and the sources of the texts is a very tricky question too, and there are different schools of thought on it. The general perspective that I've come to actually derives from one of the late Victorian collectors that I mentioned as one of Lucy's friends, Frank Kidson. Kidson really was the great pioneer of tracking down the origins of tunes and looking at the way in which they had become separated from their original text and then putting them back together again. And his general perspective was that a great deal of the tunes which at least he collected in Yorkshire
and he knew Baring Gordon, he knew Lucy, and so I think he generalised that to the tunes that they were collecting in Devon and in Sussex and Surrey, were largely from the Tudor or the Stuart era, in other words, the 16th or 17th century. But there were a fair number of tunes that also he thought were only later, usually early 18th century. And at first it was thought that a lot of the texts that were being collected in the countryside had been in oral tradition for a long time and maybe went way back to the medieval period or so. And that's, particularly was thought to be true for many of the longer, older ballads. But as far as I can see, the evidence generally points to origins on broadside, broadsheets, written ballad texts, mainly from the late Elizabethan period or most especially the first half of the 17th century. That was the great era of the broadside ballad, of the sort of big, well, the second big wave was in the early 17th century. And one of the interesting things that Baring Gould found, for example, was that he would find that texts that he collected from his source singers, who were completely illiterate and everything, you know, they'd obviously taken them from oral tradition, and these things have been handed down for generations. Yet the texts, in some cases, were virtually identical to texts that, say, Kidson was collecting in Yorkshire, which means that they must have been disseminated from a common source, because the likelihood of them, of cross-pollination from Yorkshire to Devon is very slight. So they were likely derived from London broadsides, but they'd spread out. Now what happened in the process was that they changed their tunes. So the Yorkshire tunes was different from the West Country tune. And this is what Lucy was finding. She was collecting material that, for instance, in some cases was only found elsewhere in Scotland. She collected, I think, just about maybe the second version of the ballad, Bold Lambkin, in England, but it was primarily a Scottish ballad, and yet there it was in England, and, you know, discovering an English version of it was a huge coup, you know, for a song collector at that time. But the tune, again, was different, you see. And, of course, in the case of that particular ballad, there'd been some corruption in the words and changes of the words, but it was not clearly the same ballad. So, my sense is that Kidson was basically correct in believing that a lot of the origins of what we now think of as English and Scottish and Irish and so on, folk song, are actually the creations of so-called ballad mongers, who mainly operated in the sort of London underground in the late 16th and 17th century. That was a very long answer to a short question. But I didn't get into a lot of the scholarly stuff in this talk. Now you've got some of the scholarly stuff.
David, I noticed that when you were showing the sheet music, up until Lucy Broadwood started collaborating with Henry Burstrom, that only the informant's name was listed. And then after that, the informant's name would be listed, and then /, and it was Lucy Broadwood. Now, was there any significance in that? Did the style just change, or was she...
It's not a reflection of the original. I think that's a reflection of in a sense, my own cataloging of my research. Because what I tend to do is, if there is no problem or ambiguity about it, of a version, then I just put the informant. Or if I happen to be writing an article about a collector, then I just put the collector. You have to, you see, the software insists that you put something there. at least that particular software that I was using at that time. But what increasingly as I've sort of collected together examples of songs, you know, I have the same song that in the version collected by Baring Gordon, the version collected by Broaden, collected by Kidson Sharp and Vaughan Williams and so on, you know, there are multiple versions. And so you have to sort of have something that reminds you, that, okay, this is the one that Vaughan Williams collected. So that's the reason for that. So it doesn't reflect the originals, it reflects me. And it is actually something problematic that I have to sort of rationalize and sort out. I don't know, it may also reflect the source, you know, that I took the particular, I mean, these are my own, I mean, I put the tunes into my own crummy music writing software, but some of them I obtained from manuscript sources in the archives in either Surrey History Centre in Woking or archives at Cecil Sharp House, Vaughan Williams Memorial Library and Archives, because both places have Lucy Broadwood collections, and her material is actually split between them. So there are manuscript sources, you know, her actual collecting notes and so on there. But she also, of course, published material in these three collections that I talked about, and periodically some of her collecting would appear in the Journal of the Folk Song Society, and there is in fact one issue which is almost entirely devoted to her collecting. So there are multiple sources that I've taken things from, and that sort of gets a bit reflected in the way they're actually in my files at the moment. One thing I'm hoping to do as part of the book is look very carefully at whether there are any modifications between what it appears she collected in the field and what was actually published. And I did notice, for example, that well, it's actually the trees, they do grow high, the last ballad that we had, that in her published book there is some censorship, in the sense that the age of the young lovers is, I can't remember whether it's changed, I think it's changed so that they appear older. Whereas in the Journal of the Folk Song Society, she would not, of course, change anything. You know, the aim would be at least to reproduce it exactly for scientific purposes. As editor, of course, she ran into problems that way, partly because some of the stuff they felt they couldn't even print, even in a, quote, scientific journal, and because some of the other collectors self-censored. You know, they would not submit the Outway Rood material. So, you know, that's an endemic problem. Baring Gould, who was, of course, a clergyman, has been much criticized for censoring his material. But interestingly, he was, in my opinion, very straightforward and honest about what he was doing. He would simply say, well, there are things I can't print here, and but I love this tune, so I've written my own words so that the tune won't be lost. Or he'll say, well, I had to rewrite, you know, some lines in this one, I collected this on several occasions, and the words were better from this singer, and the tune was better from this, so I put them together. But he always tells you what he's done, unlike some collectors. When she was collecting?
Yeah.
Varied. For instance, I think that when she collected Cold Blows the Wind in Devon, it looks as though she only wrote down the three verses which were different from the ones that she had already published in English County Songs. it is likely that the singer actually sang more verses, but Lucy only noted the extra ones. She was very, very excited by the extra ones, but I don't think she bothered to note down the others. We can't be absolutely sure. Rosie just, of course, sang the ones that we know that Lucy noted. But most of the time, I think she collected everything that was sung. I think later on, you see, these collectors, when they started, it was all fresh, and they didn't have a lot of previous knowledge. Lucy was actually, incredibly diligent, and one might even say anal retentive in the amount of scholarly detail and so on that she did do, and some of her technical discussions of songs are really, really detailed. And she spent months and months researching background of particular songs. But that was later, when she was an expert. In the early days, it was all fresh and new, so she'd take everything. Later on, okay, well, this is the 17th time we've come across this particular song, so we're only interested in the fact that this melody, in this version, the melody is this particular, Mixolydian mode or something. And we know that all the words are on broadsheets in any case, so, why bother to write them all down again? Ray Vaughan Williams was awful in this respect. He would just collect tunes. He would hardly ever bother to write down the words. He'd say, words are on such and such ballad sheet. Some of us are interested in the details of the differences between the works, so we are very annoyed with the Ray Vaughan Williams in terms of their collecting approaches.
Close off the recorded portion of this presentation by thanking David and Rosalyn for the wonderful presentation, and also the Research Center for sponsoring this series, and of course our attendees in the room. Thanks, David and Rosalyn.
There wasn't as much modal influence as I thought there was.